accession number 19089, reel 5.
Stephen Kennedy, reel 5.
With GHQ troop, the 8th Army Tank Protective Detachment, had three General Grant tanks, and one was for the General Commanding, Lord Montgomery, and the other two were for the G1 Ops and the second in command of the 8th Army. And in an emergency, if Rommel's commandos were to make an attack on headquarters 8th Army, they would get into these tanks and disperse for their own protection. And then, as things progressed, they would be able to come together again. They had special wireless equipment in. The actual 2-pounder gun, the 35mm gun in the front, had been removed and a wooden gun put in there. And that area where the a barrel and the fire, the breech block of the gun had been, was another wireless set, so the headquarters could communicate with each other in this emergency. And we had a crew. Lieutenant Molden was the troop officer and the tank commander of the general's tank. Corporal Fraser was the driver. Me, Sergeant Kennedy, was the gunner on the tank, and Trooper Keenan was the young lad, and he was the loader, and that made up the crew of the tank. And each day, the general would visit his corps headquarters from his GHQ. He didn't want his generals to come back to him. He would go forward to them. And we would go off earlier on and wait for him just at near Tel Elisa, which was in the Australian area, all Australian troops there. And we would wait by the side of the road, and he would come along in after a while in his staff car and then get into the tank and then go into the desert to meet up with Corps HQ, to meet up with the other generals, with the artillery range of the enemy. And you'd laugh that when we were waiting for him, these Australians come down, and they were infantry regiments, and they hadn't seen tanks, and we were trying to keep them away from it. And if you know Australians, you couldn't keep them away from anything. And though I saw a sergeant, an Australian sergeant, he said, "Would you get that chap out? He was in my turret, like, and elevating the gun." And he said, "You elegate, you go and get him out. He's our commanding officer." So eventually, we appealed to them to get out of the tanks. And luckily, the general hadn't arrived before they actually stood back. And eventually, we paraded crew front, and he would get into the tank, and off we go 5 or 6 miles into the desert to these headquarters. And he would then, they had these, the general, Corps HQs had these mobile caravans. You've seen the command, I think you said you've got one.
At the museum, yes.
And these command caravans, and they would go in there and discuss their plans. And we would have to wait in an area spread out a bit from air formation. And eventually, we have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. I remember I had a bag of Maxwell House coffee. It was the first American coffee that had come over. And it was on sale through the NAFI. And I bought myself a bag of this Maxwell House coffee. It was a change from our army tea. And we used to have a cup of tea. And eventually, the general would come back, and he saw us having a cup of tea, and he'd have one too. But the next, after a few days, we come going backwards and forwards for a number of days, And I remember he wanted to give General Lumsden, I think, a telling off, and or deal with him personally. So the two of them walked away from other generals, and there was a post sticking up at about 50 yards away, and the two of them sat back to back with their map cases on the ground. And I decided, and Lieutenant Mulder decided to take them up a cup of coffee. And I approached with these two cups of coffee within 10 yards. I said, "Can I approach you?" And they said, "Yes." And they both, sitting back to back against this post, they had their cup of coffee from us. And eventually, then we heard that the general, he was wearing an Australian hat and it was blowing off. Now, I don't know the real facts of this, but they say that Corporal Fraser, the driver, said, "You can have my berry. If this happened, so well it be." But they asked his ADC, Captain Post and the 11th Hussar, would the general wear a berry, because it's my, the 11th Hussars wore a berry, they had a brown berry with a red band around it. He said, "I'll ask him." And our lieutenant got permission from the ADC that he would wear a berry. And they also asked him, would he wear the badge of the regiment? And he said he would. So we got back to the headquarters, and they were able to order a brand new berry and with the badge in. And the Corporal Fraser, who was the one he thanked for driving him, as you can well another see, stepped forward and said, "General, will you wear our berry?" And he said, he'd already been tuned in and knew the form. He said, "Of course I will." And he wore the berry that day, and the next day he appeared in the berry and he had his general's badge beside him. He's probably the only general in the whole army that had two badges. You can remember that.
So that's the origin of why Montgomery wears
a two-badge
beret.
He wasn't actually a commandant of the Royal Tank Regiment at that time, because as you know, remember, he was an infantryman in the Warwick Regiment, I believe. And he wore the beret, and eventually he became, because of the good work done by the Royal Tank Regiment, he eventually became the Commander-in-Chief of the Royal Tank Regiment. And as days went by, and the battles progressed, and eventually they decided that there was no need for the tank protective detachments. The Germans were in retreat. They'd have to have faster vehicles to move. And of course the Sherman tank had come, and it was well and truly now equal to the German panzers. And the battle moved forward, and we were withdrawn. We had to hand over the tank. They still went forward, the protective detachment, but not with us in it, with other people. I think the Remy took them on lorries to be used in an emergency. And that the tanks, they went all the way to Tripoli eventually, but they went on, I believe, on the back of transporters. And we then were ordered to withdraw.
Can I ask you your opinion of Montgomery at that time?
Well, he was aloof from us, of course, because we were very junior rank, but he had the appearance of a real gentleman, and he was trying his best to other commanders that, you've heard of General de Gungoyne and General Freyberg and the Australian general, and they all used to gather and chat around together, and he seemed to be quite a friendly sort of man, and that's all really we could say, because we had to keep our distance from these senior officers. And eventually you'd get back into the tank, we'd drive back then to the safe area where his staff car would be waiting, we'd parade through cruise front of the tank, And the officer, troop officer, salute him and thank him. And he'd thank us, and he'd get into his staff car, and away he'd go. And then, as they say, the battle had gone so well that it was terrific to, the first night of the battle, to hear the salvo that went on. Hundreds of 25-pounders opened up on the Germans, and it went on for about 40 minutes of non-stop bombardment. And we then eventually had to go back to the remnants of our regiment. And that was the end of us in the battles for North Africa.
And what did you do when you went back?
We went back, the regiment went back to Mina by the pyramids on that main Cairo Alexander Road. And we were in amongst the remnants of various other regiments that had been regrouped. And we were beside a Sikh regiment. And they had the ceremonial incineration of their wounded when they died. And it was most amazing at night time to see this traditional ceremonial incineration of the bodies within, say, a couple of hundred yards of where we were. And then, eventually, we were equipped with a great number of lorries, and we were going to go all the way to Baghdad in Iraq. The main reason was the Germans were coming down, if you remember, through, they nearly got to the Caucasus, and this was before Stalingrad. They bypassed that area and they'd come down, and they were afraid that they were going to get into Iran and Iraq. And you know, they were the valuable oil fields and they were getting desperate for fuel. And we were to go and eventually pick up tanks south of Baghdad. And it was a most wonderful trip. You can just imagine a whole regiment in 3-ton lorries. And I had a front seat anyhow. And we went across the Suez Canal, up right across the Sinai Desert, to Gaza, to the Gaza Strip, all up along between what was beginning of Israel, and it was still Palestine, of course, all the way up to Haifa, stopping at various places at these orange groves and getting a feed. Each little orange grove had a little hut where they sold you fresh oranges, squeezed, and you drank the fresh orange juice. And then we went all the way up to Haifa, where we were equipped. And while we were at Haifa, we had to go and get supplies. And there was a Palestine police had a post up on Mount Carmel. You've heard of that in the Bible. And we were up on the top of the police post, and we had a beer up on the police post on the top of Mount Carmel. Then we moved to Nazareth. And there was a Franciscan monastery in Nazareth. And there we moved on to Cana, where the first miracle took place, and it's got a lovely church there and an inscription, Cana, the scene of the first miracle. And then we went down to the Sea of Galilee, and then we went all along the sea to the side of the Sea of Galilee, crossed over into Jordan, which was called Transjordan then, up the Golan Heights, which is a continuous part there, really steep tracks going up through these hills right up onto high ground. And we spent Christmas Day at Sidi Rezegh.
Is that 1942?
Yeah, that is Sidi Rezegh. If you remember, it was an Air Force aerodrome, but there was no Air Force there at the time, because Transjordan, it seemed, between the two wars had been run by the Royal Air Force. And this city, this place where we were, was up on the Dawson Field, it was called afterwards. And you probably remember where the Arabs destroyed a number of planes on this field. And we had our Christmas dinner there. And then we had to drive the whole way across Iraq. And there was a tarmac road, believe it, because there was an oil pipeline that run all the way from Iraq to Haifa. But because the Israel and Arabs were fighting each other, the Haifa oil port had been abandoned. And this oil pipeline had been abandoned. And it was all there. And every few miles along the road, there was these cisterns in which the desert was a black desert there. It was like the equivalent bitumen. It's like black, the raw materials for tar. And they used to dig this tar up, put it in these cauldrons, light a fire up, melt it. And they had all these Arabs pouring these buckets of molten tar to build up this road that was in the days of the oil pipeline construction most important to them. And then we went along that road all the way into Baghdad, through Baghdad, and about 25 miles south of Baghdad we camped up there. It wasn't far from Babylon really, and that we waited there, and we waited really for months. And we had a few tanks to learn about, because the General Sherman tank, it had an air-cooled engine, an aircraft engine, and we didn't know anything about air-cooled aircraft engines, and they gave us a course on those with three tanks. They were saying that our regiment of tanks would arrive at Basra at any time, but they never materialised. And we stayed there for a long time. We had a good time. We were allowed into Baghdad.
What was Baghdad like?
Baghdad had only one street available to British troops, the main street. And it was full of bars, and it was like the Midwest that you saw in the cowboy pictures. You can just imagine the tables and the floogies sitting up on the bar ready to do business. And the place, the beer was there.
He was telling me about some beer earlier on, the types of beer that you got in the Middle East.
Yeah.
Can you repeat that on the tape?
They said that it was a beer that had come from all over the world. And it was a lot of it. It was beer that was brewed in Israel. And as I said, we still had the beer from Stella Beer and other beers from Australia. And
what was the Australian beer?
The Australian was Tooheys Lager and various other ones, but I can't remember them. It was Tooheys Lager, but I remember my favourite was the one called Bulimba, bitter. And that was that, and we had that. And we had to drink the local Iraqi beer as well. But we stayed there, and honestly, it was... we were in these little tents, and all we could do was play games and just waiting for some orders to come. And we were there for months on end. And interesting thing was there was two rivers, and we went to visit. The Euphrates was on one side and the Tigris was on the other side, and we used to go to watch them fishing in the Tigris. What they did at night time, they had these little curricle things, and they had a blazing torch of tar, and they'd hold it up over the side of these curricles, and these fish, which they called Tigris salmon, which I don't believe were salmon, their flesh was white, and they'd come up and they'd clunk them on the head. So a number of these fish were still alive. And we had a sergeant's mess tent, a marquee, and we had the great thing, they got them in the rations, and some of them were alive. And they got some of these basins, you know, the five-gallon basins that you used to wash yourself in. They had these tiger salmon alive in there, and they used to feed them on bits of bread. And that was the most amazing thing there, the live fish that we had for our rations. And after a while, we then got ordered back, all the way back across Iraq again, and down into Palestine, as it was then, and from Haifa we had to go into the Lebanon. And if you remember, the Lebanon was a French colony at that time, and we were at Sidon, and it was a lovely place, a seaside resort, and we were tented on the up on the escarpment to the, on the high ground overlooking Sidon, and we stayed there for a number of months hoping to get equipment that never material. You can understand that they were doing so well in Africa and getting ready to go into Tunisia that they needed all the equipment, and the equipment that was intended for us was going there. And they were feeding us with all sorts of false stories, but people knew what was happening. Eventually we were allowed into Beirut, which was really a posh place. Beautiful corniche and posh hotels and everything, really French, Europeanized. And we had days in there, and we found the bars and drank their local Lebanese beer and got back in the trucks and came back. And we'd stayed there for a number of months, and I got posted. I left the regiment then. I was sent to the Royal Armour Corps School at Abbasia in Cairo, where I was going to be an instructor on what they call the Tank Commander's Course, gunnery side of it. And I went to the school there, I had a refresher course there, and I was an instructor there for a number of months. Eventually my 6 years in the Middle East was up, and I was on a convoy to come home. And the code name Python was the recovery from people who had done their time in the Middle East, and they were brought home mainly to give experience to the ones that were getting ready for Europe.
So when did you get posted back to the UK?
We were on these ships, and the amazing thing was a beautiful, the line, we were on a proper liner coming back. It was a P&O liner that used to go from Liverpool to Buenos Aires, and it was proper bunks and everything on it, but it had brought the South African reinforcements up, and with all their money they'd bought up everything in the canteen. So we had to go all the way just on basic rations, and we couldn't buy anything because the South Africans had bought the whole lot. And being a commercial business on the troop ships, P&O, chartered, they immediately got the money. Probably South African money was more valuable than ours. Anyhow, we sailed back, and we got all the way back, and we didn't stay at Malta. We passed close to Crete, and came back, and we got to Sicily, Porto Augusta in Sicily, and you could look up and you could see Mount Etna, and we were there, and we had a convoy of ships. There was about five or six liners, massive big liners. There was one of those Empress liners, the three funneler ones. And we had nine Greek destroyers surrounding us. And we had an aircraft carrier out in front and a cruiser. And this massive convoy used to sail along. And we stopped at Gibraltar. Well, we went very close to the coast, you know where they go now, the Costa del Sol.
The Spanish coast.
Yeah, the Spanish coast. Within sight of that, going along all the time, and it cleared of mines. And you could see the Sierra Nevada mountains and the Costa del Sol. In Gibraltar, they just sent a few of the main naval ships in there and got new supplies of water or whatever they needed. And then we sailed out into the middle of the Atlantic. We thought, when are we going to start heading north? No, we're going west. And we must have been out in mid-Atlantic. And then for a fortnight, practically, we sailed north. And we were practically in Iceland before we turned round. And then we came back down by the Hebrides and all those islands and came back into... Eventually, we stopped at Glasgow for a bit and then came back into Liverpool. And we disembarked in Liverpool.
What date was that, roughly?
It's in the winter time, anyhow.
Is that the end of 1943?
It probably was. I can't remember the exact time. But it was long before the Europe business started. And we arrived at the docks in Liverpool. And the reinforcement centre where everybody from disembarkation went to before they got documented to go on disembarkation leave was in a council. A whole council estate was taken over. And it was marvellous that all the women that had been evacuated from into hostels from this estate were lined up and they had their prams, and on their prams they had a breadboard and they had every goodie that you could imagine in those ration days. And it was the most of a wonderful sight to see these English girls, and they were helping you with tea or coffee, donuts, everything. And after the rigidness and the horribleness on board the ships, like, you know, and the strictness, to see these people, and they were doing everything for you. And eventually we got our disembarkation leave, and we did it so many months back in Ireland, I did. And then came back, and from Liverpool, I got posted then to Lyonsea in Essex.